This is the Meeting Web Kids on Their Own Turf panel discussion. And my name's Kate Wittenberg. I'm the PI on Core Integration and the Director of the Electronic Publishing Initiative at Columbia University. I'll be setting the scene here and moderating and making a few comments toward the end, but what I really want to do is focus on our panelists, who will talk about some interesting new ideas that may give us some thoughts about moving forward. Just to set the scene for this discussion, I think it's pretty obvious to all of us, and also was very nicely highlighted in the keynote talk earlier today, that things are definitely changing in terms of users' behavior and the spaces and the places and the environments in which they're beginning to work and play. Just some quick examples and just a survey of sort of our own environment in which I work. One of the big current crises at Columbia is that there are plenty of students still coming to the library where our offices happen to be located. But what's happening is they're coming to the library mostly to use the coffee bar and then to use the wireless network where they use their computers to search for their research materials on Yahoo and Google, despite the fact that the libraries have redesigned their web page portal to all of their subscription digital resources about four times in the last year, trying always to make it something more like what students seem to want to use. Now, does that matter or not? Well, librarians think it matters because that they worry that they won't have people using the reference services or the resources, but the students seem to feel that they end up getting what they need anyway, and so does it really matter where they start? Well, that's sort of one point to consider in thinking about digital libraries. The library at Columbia now has a profile on Facebook, and it has 1,000 friends. What does that mean? People are letting the library be in their community of friends, and they're sort of going to look through the library and its resources, but not through the library portal again, but through the Facebook profile that it has. MySpace has a book section now where users create very, in my opinion, sophisticated and interesting reviews of books. So what does that mean for publishers? If bands make cult reputations through the way that they are recommended by MySpace users, does that mean anything for publishers of materials that might be interesting to younger users? And then finally, there was that interesting article in Wired magazine a couple months ago where a reporter talked to some recruiters for young people applying for jobs from some of the firms that want to hire people, not necessarily for technology jobs, but for other kinds of jobs. And they said that at this point, if someone has on a resume that they're a guild master in World of Warcraft, that's counted as a big plus. And why? Well, because recruiters assume they have excellent project management, team building, and problem solving skills. Now, I don't know if parents would agree when 11-year-olds spend 5 or 6 hours playing World of Warcraft, but that's certainly an interesting item to note that's come out recently. Now, whether this all means something for educators and digital library developers and publishers is a huge question. I wrote the article that sort of spurred this panel for the Chronicle of Higher Ed last summer, and it was published a couple of weeks before the annual meeting of the Association of American University Presses, and the Chronicle distributes their copies there, and the article was there, and there was really deafening silence from most all of the senior managers and directors of university presses. I mean, I felt very clearly that it wasn't an appreciative article, and really all it said was the publishers need to sort of wake up and look at what's going on and think about perhaps forming new partnerships. I'd be pleased to know the only press director came up to talk to me and say she loved the article as a director at MIT Press, which is interesting given what they're doing there. And I'm not really criticizing my colleagues in my whole industry. I'm simply saying that I don't think it's always immediately clear how what's going on in a fairly young user community is important to us. And that's why I think this is a really great panel to have here, because it'll give us a chance to talk through some of the opportunities and possibly challenges that we're going to be facing. It's clear that these young users are going to continue moving forward with their exploration and their experimentation, with or without us. I think the real question for us is, are we going to respond, and if so, how? How will it affect what we're doing in our research labs and in our publishing operations and in our educational settings? And will we need to start talking to some new partners and some new collaborators beyond the people that we've traditionally worked with? The panel that we have assembled for this session is very well positioned to give us some interesting models and some examples of these kinds of partnerships that we might consider. So I'll introduce the panelists, who will speak for approximately 10 minutes each, and then I'd really like to open this up to discussion and comment from the audience so we can find out what issues you think are relevant and whether you have ideas and questions and some further topics that we should be thinking about while we're all here together. The panelists today, from my left here, are Julie Evans, who's the CEO of NetDay Project Tomorrow, who's been studying students' and teachers' use of educational technology for some time, since 2002, and who has a great deal of data, some of which she'll share with us. The next panelist is Karen Weber, who's a principal designer in research and development at Yahoo. And the final panelists who will split their presentation are Jennifer Groth, who's program manager, and Eric Rosenbaum, who's research manager from the MIT Education Programs and the MIT Education Arcade. So we're going to start with Julie and then move through.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm very thrilled to be here. I actually was with you last year also when you were in Denver, so I was thrilled to be invited back to share some of our data. Let me start off by telling you a little bit about the national research project that we've been doing for the last couple years. Kate mentioned about students and teachers, so I'm just going to give you a little bit of a background on that before we get started. Eric, what am I doing wrong here? I'm sorry. I wasn't on slideshow. So sorry.
That works.
That would help. It is an annual research project. We do it every fall. The surveys are 100% online, and they are open to any K-12 school in the country to participate with their students, their teachers. This year, we're actually having a survey for parents, and so we're going to be comparing what students, teachers, and parents are telling us about their use of technology, what their thoughts are regarding 21st century skills, what their thoughts are regarding math and science education. For the teachers, we asked them about professional development. And also very germane to this conversation today, we actually have a number of questions that we have framed working with the Hewlett Foundation about open education resources for the teachers this year. So that will be in next year's data. Our focus with this is to collect the data and report it out, both nationally and locally. Schools that participate get all of their data. But more importantly, it's to stimulate new conversations. And that's why I'm particularly pleased to be here with you today as part of that stimulating of new conversations. Our data has been used to inform national policy, state policy, as well as local programs. And as you can see, we have, as Kate mentioned, quite a lot of data. About 588,000 students and teachers have taken the survey from all 50 states over the last couple years. The data I'm going to share with you is specifically from last year's survey, of which we had 185,000 students and 15,000 teachers take the survey. You can see the demographic split on the survey. A couple key findings that came out of the survey, or what we published out as our key findings, was that students are definitely setting the trends regarding the use of technology in schools. Communications is huge. I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about some of the statistics we've gathered on communications and how students are using communications tools. And another one that was interesting was that, in fact, the youngest students, we do this poll K-12, but the youngest students in our poll are actually much more sophisticated in their use of technology, both for their learning life and their entertainment life, than, in fact, their older siblings. And that's always very surprising when I do presentations both to teachers and to older siblings. And then the other key finding we had is that while teachers are catching up, they haven't caught up. So in the question of are we on the same page, are we on the same page with today's web kids? Are our K-12 teachers on the page with the web kids? And so we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Some big ahas. So beyond the key findings, the big ahas that came out of our work, and this is over the last couple of years, is that, in fact, we can't paint with a broad brush that all kids are using technology in a certain way. And sometimes we are too quick to say, well, all kids are doing this and all kids are doing that. And, in fact, we see a lot of differentiation, whether it is based on some differentiation still on gender, and I'll talk to you about that, some on age, we talked about that, demographic, where they're from, the types of activities, and also things such as whether they consider themselves an advanced tech user or not. And I'll give you some examples of that. The kids do want to be part of content creation. And in fact, I'll give you an interesting statistic on that. And that's part of an overall trend that we've seen over the last couple of years, where the students really want to take more and more control over the destiny of their own education. You know, we have seen that in the higher ed environment over the last couple of years, but it is truly alive and well in the K-12 environment. Whereas in the K-12 environment, and actually in higher ed as well, there has been the presumption that the teacher is the bastion of all knowledge and the student is the vessel to be filled. In fact, students don't even come into the classroom today believing that or even thinking about it that way. They look at their K-12 formal education as just an extension of their overall education environment, and that's very interesting, and that obviously has big implications not only for K-12 education but for content creation. And then the third big aha that we had is that the way the students themselves are thinking about content is very different than what you and I think about content. They are much more focused on the interaction and the process than on the product. And I'll give you an example of that as we move into more data. Just a sort of a laundry list, the types of things that K-12 students are involved with, the types of tech tools they're involved with. As far as the online tools, we think of it as the big three: gaming, music, and communications, whether it's email or online communications. Of that, across the board, K-12, gaming is the number one favorite activity of students online, followed by music. And even the youngest students are involved today with listening to music online, downloading music, doing mixes of music. They're all doing that. And then the email and instant messaging come after that. The tipping point on the communication side with the youngest students has now fallen to sixth grade. I know that some folks in the Department of Education still say it's seventh or eighth grade. Actually, per our data, it's sixth grade. That's the point where we see 50% of the students, girls and boys together, no gender split there, have access email or instant messaging on a weekly basis. Let me delve just a little bit deeper on the email and instant messaging thing. One of the also interesting things we picked up this year was that when we disaggregate between email and instant messaging beats email every day of the week. What we found from the kids is that email for them today is a storage medium. They will send an email to themselves with an attachment from home to use in school. But as far as communication with friends, with peers, it's instant messaging. It's part of that instant gratification. And the thing that's interesting about that is that we also saw this year, finally, the tipping point where a majority of teachers are saying that they're emailing their students. So how interesting that the teachers are getting to the point of using email at the same point that the students are walking away from it. Some of you may have heard me say this last year. What we're hearing from the kids, and I hope this doesn't shock you, is that email is just for grandparents. Think about that. The kids say that they learn about technologies on their own. They're self-exploring. They also are learning about it from their friends. I had a fabulous focus group at a middle school recently and was talking to a group of 5th and 6th graders who told me, it was an upper elementary, it was a K-8, 5th and 6th graders, who told me that at lunchtime they share URLs, exchange them on their lunch bag. I think that's really interesting. I don't know if any... I mean, you used to share your peanut butter sandwich. I'll take your fluffer nutter for my peanut butter. Now they're sharing URLs. I think that's really interesting. Let's go on. We talked a little bit about communication tools. There is the presumption that, as I said, with email and instant messaging, that that is the preferred communications tool. Actually, what we're seeing is that cell phones are beating it every day of the week, and cell phones for talking at this point. We're seeing younger and younger students coming to schools with cell phones, which in the K-12 environment is creating a number of policy and program issues that we are going to be probing even further this year with this year's survey. I'm just going to whip through these. What is the number one thing that students are doing outside of internet research? And this gets into our content creation, because in fact what they're telling us is that they are creating slideshows, iMovies, videos, all sorts of different things using the internet tools. And it is part of their way of what they consider authentic assessment or authentic performance assessment. They consider it a very authentic means for them to be able to demonstrate to their teachers what they know. Interestingly, this beat out, as you can see, checking on an online grade, taking an online test. And in the K-12 environment, there has been a lot of conversations about putting together school websites, class websites, portals, and in fact, the creating of the content beat all of those. What do kids like best about using technology? Well, I think this is really interesting and goes to the sophistication level of the students in terms of their use of technology. What they say is that the information is more accurate and it helps them be more efficient as a learner. Now, you know, when this whole technology gig started, you know, we all talked about the promise of technology was going to make us more efficient. I don't know if we really realized that. But from the kids' standpoint, they see it that way. And in fact, I've talked to kids all around the country, including in some very highly challenged communities, that say that they cannot rely at this point upon their teacher or upon their textbooks or upon their physical library for having the most accurate information, that in fact they're dependent on the internet for giving them into that sort of information. Just a little bit on the teachers. Teachers are using the same type of tools. We do not see teachers using the instant messaging as much. Oh, and on the communication side, I wanted to tell you a little bit just really quickly about MySpace. I was reminded about because we have not seen teachers utilizing MySpace. We saw from 2004 to 2005 a 3x increase in the number of 6th graders through 12th graders that were regularly updating their MySpace page. That follows the trend that we've been seeing in the news. What was very interesting about it, though, is that when we disaggregated the data and looked at it from a couple different parameters, the students that told us that they were the most technology advanced, so they did a self-assessment, considered themselves advanced tech users, were the least likely to have a MySpace page. That, in fact, it was the beginning level technology user or the technology user that was more social, maybe in their interaction, that was gravitating to MySpace. And it was very interesting because it sort of went to that point of you can't paint this group of learners with a broad brush and say, well, every kid is on MySpace. It was a very interesting result that we had. When we asked teachers about the impact that technology has had on their life, overwhelmingly it is in teaching and instructional support, which always surprises my K-12 audiences because they are expecting to see more around communications, classroom management, even assessment. But it's interesting. What teachers consider teaching and instructional support, though, so that you understand, is creating a newsletter for parents, possibly, or creating a lesson plan. They do realize, teachers have realized, that, in fact, technology has had an impact on their students, and they look at it from a standpoint of engagement in school, collaboration, and student achievement. You know, in the K-12 world, there's a great deal of conversation about having one-to-one laptop programs where every student has a laptop that they have access to. When we pull out from our data just schools that have those sort of programs, we see that collaboration number just go through the roof. And so it is sort of the beginnings of proof positive that, at least from a collaboration standpoint, from a teamwork standpoint, that having that sort of ubiquitous access does have an impact. This is a funny one. We asked teachers, what EdTech trend do you think has the greatest potential for student achievement? Sometimes with audiences, I'll take them, have a poll on this. Despite all the wonderful technology that we have out there and all the wonderful opportunities that we have, teachers at this point are looking for a school or class website, which I think, points a pretty clear picture that at this point we have our students that are very technology advanced, that are into content creation, are really pushing the envelope in terms of how to use technology. And unfortunately for many of our K-12 teachers, they're still looking at it from an online grading system. In terms of obstacles, every year we have asked this question. It's been very interesting to see the migration over 3 years. What's the greatest obstacle to using technology more at your school? The students are resoundingly say that you're confining us, that there are too many rules. There are rules against using email and instant messaging. There's rules about when I can use technology. There's rules about what I can do with technology. There's rules about what type of products I can use. They are very focused in on all the confining elements of technology use. Teachers are saying, give us more computers, give us faster online access. So once again, a disconnect there. And then when we ask sort of a parallel question, we ask the students, if you were interested in designing a new school for kids just like you, the kids talk about wanting to have direct access to some type of device where they can do the types of things that they want. And the key thing is to be able to take home, so that they have really what they consider ubiquitous learning time that blends together the informal and the formal learning, and that they have the access to those tools. Teachers are, again, still on access. So what is sort of the bottom line of all this? And we have, I should just tell you, we have a lot more data than what I have shared here. And Brad graciously has put it up on the web blog for this particular session. So you can see access to our national report and lots of different data that's on there, as well as what our plans are for this year. Students are definitely pushing the envelope. The teachers are adopting, but still in a much less creativity and much less faster pace. The students' attitudes reflect what we think they are. They're digital natives, and so their approach to technology, the approach that they take to using technology, in fact, the approach they're taking to learning today reflects that digital native status. Our teachers' attitudes, as many of us are probably of the same status here, are more of an immigrant. We're still learning how to do the work that we were doing before and now using this technology. As far as visions of the future, as I said, the students are definitely defining the future. They're shaping it. In some cases, they're shaping it outside of their school time. And we have many, many examples of students that say that their most vivid and most enthusiastic learning opportunities are happening outside of their K-12 school environment, not inside their K-12 school environment. And the teachers are starting to catch up, but once again, it's slow, as I gave you with the email example. Thank you very much.
Is happening, new technologies and new devices showing up all the time. We have teachers that are actually making class blogs and being able to have their classes themselves blog, and whether or not it's the classroom blog known as Mrs. Smith's blog or it's, you know, the eighth grader's blog, there are ways of being able to do new kinds of citizen journalism and new kinds of reporting that are being used in classrooms. We also see there are new technologies. I was on the plane yesterday and saw this article in the paper that the Federation of American Scientists have said and weighed in that video games can reshape education. I thought that was absolutely timely given the course of this discussion. We know that kids are engaged by interactive technology. We know that they're developing new skills. And while some of us may think that they are just kind of going into the zone, it actually turns out not only are they being able to use these kinds of technologies to enhance their learning, but those kinds of mechanisms are helping those who have trouble learning different ways. My own personal example is I have a daughter who's trying to learn the times tables, and me holding up flashcards doesn't work very well. But her doing multiplication tables in a flashcard-based program makes her think that she's actually playing a game, and she's being incredibly successful at it. No way am I going to take that away from her. Also, we're seeing new devices. Lots of reports these days about new pieces of tech, new players in the field putting out their courseware on iPods and looking at how to bring this education into the mobile world. You're driving along. We used to think, oh, I'll listen to a book on tape. Now I can listen to a lecture on tape. I can take my students' courseware, or in the case of this lecture, and take it on my iPod and listen while driving to work. We see that it's happening, and it's a trend, and it's not going away. If you think about how teachers in the past have traditionally used the web, we've heard a lot about how teachers go to the web to find lesson plans. Let me inherit or use a derivative work someone else has done to help me teach something. So I wanted to do this example of today, how we use traditional media, using an example of a teaching how to teach great giant pandas. We're in Washington, by the way, so we need to look at something local. And then look at how we might use some of these new social medias and how those kinds of results might show up. So I went on the web and typed in panda lesson plan. First hit I got was this wonderful World of Pandas example done by a teacher in Oakland from the third grade. And you can see that she's been able to actually build a PowerPoint presentation where she can talk about where pandas live, what they eat, and what they look like, and including references and sourcing. And that notion of citation is actually really important, and the notion about being able to attribute where the information came from. Well, being from Yahoo, I did a standard old search on pandas, and sure enough, not only did I find an amazing number of hits, but if I go in and look at those, you can see in the first top page, I'm getting, you know, the Yahoo Ligon's page on pandas, which was actually done by Editorial Content for kids to understand pandas. I can go to the San Diego Zoo and see their giant panda cam, which is pretty cool. World Wildlife Foundation and the Smithsonian's National Zoo panda site. Those are all very good, solid resources that I could imagine if I were a teacher being able to take into the classroom. I could also make it so that it was media type specific, so just do image searches or just do video searches and be able to have those there as well. And being that we're here at the NSDL meeting, I should also be able to go in and do a search on your site, which I did. And you can see that not only get some of the same sources, I do get very unique, what I'll call vertical results. So the fact that I'm getting, as the first hits, sets of bone structures out of the panda's jaw, that's exactly what I would expect a science digital library to be giving me. And so that aggregation between what I could get on Yahoo in terms of its broad fire hose on pandas and then the more vertical web search seems to be a very good and solid way of being able to support people getting access to educational resources. But there's a new trend afoot. Some people call it Web 2.0. Some people call it social media. Some people call it user-generated content. Some people call it social search. The idea is that you're actually able to put media, technology, and people together, where the consumers are now creating the very content that they're consuming. This includes things like video and photo sharing, blogging, podcasting, IM, wikis, social networks, etc. And we can see that there are lots of places where this is starting to surface. It promotes people finding, using, sharing, and expanding upon all kinds of content in order to expand human knowledge. And it's got built on platforms with open systems and applications that connect these people, the technology, and the media together, forming a new kind of value creation network. So using and looking at a simple example, Wikipedia, here's a place where we actually did a search on giant pandas. And sure enough, what I found here was a very beautiful page, image of a panda, and a very nice content a description of all the different kinds of places I could look and promote me to go look about giant pandas. Now, where things get kind of interesting is the fact that people can actually add links to that. So in this case, off the Wikipedia page, I'm able to click on a link and get taken to a page on Sichuan. And in there, but I hope I'm not saying that province incorrectly, there what I'm getting is that's where it turns out one of the largest panda reserves are in China. The fact that some people are actually thinking about that interconnection and the related content and building up those networks of information connection is a pretty interesting way of starting to think about how the world can help each other find content. By providing the context, we're able to actually provide a framework or a skeletal structure on how we want to move through knowledge based on what common people are thinking. Now, granted, there are a lot of questions have been raised about the validity of the content and how do you know who's written the article. And I think those are challenges that we're all facing now and how to actually understand who's editing or who could be editing such content on Wikipedia. At Yahoo, we have a lot of social media projects. I'm going to talk about three and do the same kind of panda example there and show you how those results would change. So those three projects are Delicious, Yahoo Answers, and Flickr. For those of you who know Yahoo products, you can also find those in travel and trip planner and autos and in shopping. The notion about being able to have public participation in how you generate the content. Okay, so let's look at Delicious. Delicious is a social bookmarking product. Basically, when I go out and I find something interesting, I can add my vote to it as being interesting. So here's the PandaCam example. And it says that I can also add user notes, and it can tell me how many people have actually saved this as some important site. In this case, 130 people on Delicious saved this as an important site. And they give me an example of what they thought about it. And more importantly, they're able to tag that, add keywords to it, so that I can actually get other context or other places to search based on what I've seen. Now, what's really interesting, if you look at the tags here, and I'm assuming most of you know how tag structures work, but the size of the tag equals the number of people who have actually voted for that term. So the term panda is quite large, and webcam and zoo are quite large, but adorable is pretty small. So you can start to see that you'll start to get a social lexicon and taxonomy formed, but there are ways of telling you how relevant something is by what the community is thinking. Delicious has been very popular, and in fact, there's even a place that is now starting to aggregate what elementary school teachers are marking on Delicious, and that's teachinghacks.com. And the fact that the community itself has decided we're strong enough to actually be able to say here are all the elementary school teachers that are marking things gives you a way of understanding a bit more about the community. Yahoo Answers is a brand new product for Yahoo. It's been out for about 10 months. And what it is a way of being able to literally ask a question, get an answer, or discover an answer to a question. So what I can do is simply type in a question, what are giant pandas? And then I get an answer back from whoever happened to care to answer my question. Right now, in the 6 months that it's been up, there are about 60 million unique users and about 120 million answers worldwide on the system. What's interesting is when I get an answer back, there's actually a way of telling who's answered that question and what their reputation is and what their credibility is. For those of you who use eBay, you might think about this as, how do I know about their rating? Are they a good seller or not? That is also happening in the knowledge exchange world. So in this case, Ipswitz has 6,243 points. He's answered 1,002 questions, and 322 of them have been voted best by either the asker of the question or by the community itself. That seems to help a lot. As we heard this morning, one of the questions that came up is, how do we build in reputation and rating into our systems? And this seems to be a really good first stab at trying to put that into play. Now, I looked across the questions. One of the things you can do in Answers is just ask and see what other questions have been answered. And I put in giant pandas, and I found this really quite unique question that was said. Are there trips to see giant pandas, and where should I go? Now, what was very cool is in the answers that this person got was the response, the only panda preserve is located in Chengdu, and it also happens that I'm in Chengdu now to take my niece to see the pandas there. We'll check out the conditions at the zoo today and then the base camp research center tomorrow. The notion of the immediacy of information harkens back to what was said a few moments ago about kids not believing that the information is necessarily most current. They're not going to find out what those research center conditions are in a textbook. It would be really interesting to find out if that was actually there on a web page that wasn't part of the research center. But because somebody's in the field, actually there, they're able to share their real-life experiences. They're able to tell you whether something's, bring special boots, or it's very hard to walk through the terrain, or only go on Tuesdays because that's when they wash the pan. I mean, I don't know what the real situation is, but the fact that the information is immediate and real, and it's coming from real people. And you might say, well, how do we know that guy is really there? You know, that's a pretty unique opportunity. Well, it turns out, if you look at his questions and answers, he just had asked the questions, if you're in a foreign family living in China, please suggest some clean places for kids to stay and have fun. Well, I kind of have to believe if he's asking for clean places to stay with kids, he really is taking his niece to go to this preserve. The last site I wanted to spend a couple moments on is something called Flickr, which is a social photo sharing site. And I don't know how many of you have ever used Flickr, but basically you can take your photos and you upload them to Flickr and can make them public or make them private. And then the ones that are public, you can go in and search for. In the case of pandas, I found 47,000 photos of pandas on Flickr, which I thought was actually pretty amazing. But what was even more amazing was on the day that I was looking, which was on September 12th, all these pictures on the right-hand side were uploaded by unique users. There were almost 20 unique users that had uploaded panda photos on September 12th. Now, I checked, it's not National Panda Day. What does that say to you about how many people are actually aggregating and adding new content to the system? Well, it turns out that Flickr currently has about 5 million registered users, and about between 800,000 and 1.2 million users a day at the site, and about a million photos uploaded a day, and 80% of them are public. That's really striking if you sort of start to think about that. I didn't realize that so many people worldwide were taking photos. But think about that as from an archival standpoint. How do you make that indexed and make that accessible? I think one of the things that's actually really cool about that is that the world is getting covered. There are images of things there that I can't find anywhere else. And one of the more interesting things from an educational standpoint is because it's based on tags, I can find things that I otherwise wouldn't be able to find pictures of. So in working with a group of teachers, they went in and put words like rigid into Flickr and got amazing photographs to use to help explain spelling words to their students because they found hard metal cases. Or the concept of few and many. Those are tags in Flickr. If I search for few and many on Yahoo Images, I wouldn't get the kinds of appropriate content delivered back. I have to ask, being from California, that's just some kind of hum or whatever, right? Okay. Sorry, we're used to earthquakes. I'm looking for doorways. The last kind of thing that I wanted to talk about Flickr is the notion of now being able to geocode those photos. So being able to use certain cell phones, you can actually automatically apply a lat long to any photo and be able to actually have it placed on the map. And when I went to Flickr and looked at where that preserve was in China and clicked on it, sure enough, there were my panda photos. And not only that, I got to see from this person's collection all the other photos that they had taken from that area as well. So being able to deliver geographical context about what was going on in and around those pandas, and if you can see, there are pictures of people, there are pictures of buildings, there are pictures of food, the notion of the fact that no longer are we now able just to teach those pandas, we're able to teach those pandas in context. And the notion about being able to use social media to both talk about the people, the places, and the things that people are doing without having to actually index each one starts to change, I think, our ability to look at what we can do in the educational space. So in conclusion, we like to propose the notion about being able to do education 2.0, where educators create the very content they're consuming and they share it amongst themselves, where they actually find, use, and share and expand upon all kinds of media for themselves and for others, and that the platforms we build are actually open systems that will allow them to connect to each other and allow them to connect with technology and actually build a new kind of educational system. Thanks.
Just a moment.
Yeah, like I said, I was sitting there and the podium started shaking.
Oh,
Good morning. My name is Jennifer Groff, and I'm here with my colleague Eric Rosenbaum. We're from the Teacher Education Program at MIT. It's a small program there, started about 10 years ago. We have several focuses of work, but one of them is to certify undergraduates who are interested in getting teacher certification. So they come to us and complete the program before usually finishing their undergraduate degree. But we also do research and development in handheld technologies and how that can be used for learning. So portable technologies, what are they, and why are we trying to leverage them for learning? They're popping up all over the place, as has been said here many times already. Students are plugging in all different ways, and one of the ways they're doing this is with portable technologies. Things that can fit with them easily in their pockets at all times. You can pick it up and play anytime on the cell phone, PlayStation, Game Boy. Some of you may remember Tamagotchi. It was a toy that came out several years ago where you had to keep a pet alive, a digital pet, and also Palm Pilots and Pocket PCs. So our lab focuses mainly on these two technologies. We've developed applications, simulations, and games for these two technologies. And so that's what Eric and I will be talking about today, giving you an insight into that, the technologies that we've been developing and doing research on for both of these platforms. We build on six principles and why we think these make for powerful learning technologies. The first is portability. Obviously, it's a lot easier to bring around or use in a classroom than a desktop or a laptop even. In a lab classroom with computers everywhere, you know, any teacher can tell you how tough it is to manage it and keep classroom control and schedule time to get into the lab. So the portability of these technologies really leverage a lot of possibilities for learning. And they can also take them home a lot easier than other technologies as well. And ubiquity, they are showing up all over the place. If the schools aren't delivering these, which many are not, the kids are coming to school with them. And this is where you kind of feel that rub of students saying there's so many rules. When I was teaching, there was lots of kids who had Palms and mainly iPods and other types of technologies like that that wanted to use them in school. And just as I was leaving that placement, they took that away. They took away the right for students to bring any type of that technology into the school. And I was using iPods in my classroom, so needless to say, I was kind of upset about that. Connectivity, you can connect these devices in many ways. In a classroom lab, you're kind of stuck with the server or how they're connected through the cables in the classroom, but these can connect in several different ways. They can be connected with Wi-Fi. You can do peer-to-peer infrared beaming to exchange data and information, and they also can be GPS-enabled to collect information and connect other ways in different locations. And this will leverage, then, social interactivity. There's many ways for students to collaborate and communicate and interact, not only face-to-face, but also purely through the technology or some combination of the two. It's also context sensitive. So since these can be location aware through various technologies such as GPS enabling, they can pick up different information and data based on where you are, much more so than other types of technologies can. So since they can be with the student no matter where they are, they can be context sensitive and pick up information wherever that student is. And also individuality. They really lend themselves to tailoring to the individual needs of the learner and using it in their own individual space. So whereas sometimes classrooms that have only six computers and students have to share or work and let one person drive while the other one watches, these lend themselves much easier to each student using in their own individual way for learning. So today we'll be talking about handheld learning games that we develop in our lab. And they're social learning games, so it's very much student interaction using the games. I'll be talking today about participatory simulations that we mainly build for the Palms, which you see on the left. And then Eric will be speaking about augmented reality games, which we primarily build for Pocket PCs, which you see on the right. And here's just some photos of students using them on our campus. So I'll start with the participatory simulations. Just a big word that we use for simulation games we make for learning. So here's students using the Palms, using the games in a classroom. It really, what makes them unique is it puts the students in a simulated world. So it's a simulated context that isn't actually occurring, which allows them to make errors, to play and move in space that is virtual, so they feel more comfortable in trying and exploring than they might in an actual activity in real life. It's highly engaging for the students. Since we can simulate things, it becomes more like play, more like the games that they're using in their personal time. And using the technology is always an engaging factor, as any teacher, I'm sure, can tell you. This will be the the foundation for an engaging, rich learning experience. So certainly pedagogy is still important in using these technologies in the proper manner, but this lays the foundation for a rich learning experience. And what really makes them powerful is they're simple and cheap technologies. The Palm Zire that you're looking at here, you can get for about $100, which is relatively inexpensive when you think about the other technologies that schools are faced with buying for students to use. And the Palms are used peer-to-peer communication, so they use infrared beaming. So students will do work on their Palm and then beam to another Palm to exchange data. So after doing that, I can see the information that you've been working on in your Palm and have it right there in my Palm next to my data to compare. We can discuss, and I can aggregate classmates' data, and the teacher can do this as well. I can pull all of your data onto my Palm and look at it in one big list. So some of the simulations that we've developed is a game called Genetics. It teaches about DNA, and students, I should mention, in all these simulations have to interact together. So although they work individually or in teams or pairs, it's really the collective whole, communicating, spreading that data, and then problem solving as a group that allows them to work through the simulation. So here you're looking at the Genetics game that we've developed. Most of these can be played within one classroom. Another one's called Big Fish, Little Fish. Teaches ecology. Students take on either the role of a big fish school or a school of small fish. So again, taking on these simulated characters or simulated roles that they otherwise would not be playing out. And so as a class, you either eat the little fish. So if I beam you and you're a little fish and I eat you, that affects your game. And so you can have this interactive dynamic going on in your classroom by have each student having their own character or role in the game. And another one we have is Sugar and Spice, which is, I believe, the only one we have not in the sciences, which teaches microeconomics concepts, trading and things like that. Keep going. One game that we've developed that's a little bit outside of this scope is a game based off the Tamagotchi that I was mentioning earlier. This was a big hit with lots of kids, so we tried to look at what concepts are actually skills that we can then map onto learning experiences in the classroom. So we took the concept of the Tamagotchi and mapped it onto a pocket PC, and we came up with Pamagotchi. And this is very much still in development, and we hope to be using it with classes this fall. But the difference here, since it is a pocket PC, and Eric will expand more on this technology later, but these are wired together through a server, so the game is always going on. It's constantly being played. And the screen you're looking at here is students who have a set of birds. So it's based on ecology and evolution is what it's focused at teaching. And the network handheld that I mentioned. But the goal of the game is to teach. It's based on Darwin's finches. So the goal is to keep your birds alive, and you breed them with other students' birds, and there's flowers that they interact with and pollinate with, depending on beak length and things like that. So the game is constantly going on. It takes about a week that you can play it, but what makes it unique is that the students manage this outside the classroom. So they keep the Palm, or the pocket PC, excuse me, and they do the activity outside of classroom time, because it doesn't take much time, and it's always going on. So they manage their birds and flowers outside of class time, and then they use the class time to analyze the data and discuss in class. So it's really leveraging more learning time than what this teacher has available inside the classroom. And just another screenshot from the game. The bird Cracker was their name. Cracker was attacked while traveling, but luckily survived. So I'm going to pass to Eric now, who's going to talk about augmented reality.
Thanks, Jen. So you heard about one set of our handheld games. So those are primarily within the classroom, and they work in a peer-to-peer way. So the students interact in a pairwise fashion, and they look at dynamics that happen over the entire group. So our augmented reality games are a different category of games. So these are also simulations, but we try to bring them further out into the real world. And so what we're doing is using location-aware technology. So these pocket PCs you can connect to a GPS unit. That's what's shown in the photo there. And then it knows where you are in space. You can get latitude and longitude coordinates. And so what we do is we create a virtual space that's overlaid onto a real physical space. So virtual characters and objects and other things can be spread around a real environment. So that way you get information from your real surroundings and from your virtual surroundings. And in that way, so we create problem-solving scenarios. So the kids roam around with their devices and they collaborate and try to solve them. That's a little abstract, so I'm going to tell you about a few games that we have actually made in this paradigm that have some interesting differences among them also. So the first one I'm going to talk about is called Environmental Detectives. There's a screenshot of it there, so you can see the satellite map. That's actually of MIT campus. It's a little small, so hard to tell. So it's being played in our neighborhood. And then there are little dots on it that show where the locations of the different types of virtual objects are. So what you do is you navigate in the virtual space and strategize about where to go next in terms of what virtual information is located where. So this one, Environmental Detectives, is a scenario about a toxic spill. So there's been some construction, and there's a rash of health problems at the same time. So it turns out that there's been a construction accident. There's a toxic chemical in the groundwater. So what the students have to do is go around and find out what's caused this, what chemical's really there, what are the implications of it, where is it specifically located. And so what they can do is walk around, and they interview, first of all, virtual characters like the construction officials, the workers, and professors who might have some expertise. Now, these are just virtual people, so their testimony shows up on the device in a little video or text snippet. And then they can also do things like gather data more directly. So they can drill a virtual sample well wherever they think the epicenter of the spill might be. And so there's a time delay, so you can't just do it everywhere and anywhere. So you have to strategize about where to do it. And then the kids have to combine their data together. And so what they can do is look at their readings, which have some uncertainty in them as well, and try to trace back to where the origin of the spill occurred. So it shares a lot of features of real science inquiry, gathering data and making inferences. And at the end, they have to articulate their findings, so synthesizing this data that they gathered in different ways and put it together into a plan. So that's one game, Environmental Detectives. Next one I'll talk about is called Outbreak at MIT. So this is a simulation of a disease outbreak. Here's some kids playing it. So what makes this one different is that this is a networked game. So in that previous one, it was based on GPS, and so each of the students' handhelds is sort of independent in terms of the information that it receives. They work separately. The students collaborate, but the devices are independent. So here, they're connected to a network all the time. So instead of GPS positioning, we use Wi-Fi positioning, just a different technology. But that means what we can do is situate the simulation in a single world that all the students interact in. That means, for example, there's a virtual item in a room. So in this case of a disease outbreak, we have things like vaccines, very important. But if I pick up the virtual vaccine in the room, that means it disappears from your screen, so you can't pick it up. The scenario is that, bird flu has shown up on the MIT campus. We try to make it topical. It's actually pretty scary for the kids once they get into the role-playing aspect of it. But they have tools. So they're charged with the task of finding out who originally had this disease and then containing the outbreak. So there's an underlying disease model according to which the disease spreads through the population of virtual characters in the game. The players can also get sick, which has a big effect on the kids' perceptions of it. And so they have tools like using vaccines, like I mentioned. They have diagnostic tests that they can use that have some uncertainty. And they can also quarantine the virtual characters. And so they use this combination of tools that are spread among different roles that they have, which makes them need to collaborate, to try to stop the outbreak. So those two games are both about collaborating to solve a problem. This third one I'm going to talk about is a little bit different. It's called POSIT, and it's about developing public opinions on science. So the idea here is to get kids engaged in debate about science controversies. It's a difficult thing to do. We're partnering with the MIT Museum, who is faced with this task of getting kids engaged in the real-world issues. And so we decided to build a game around this using that same augmented reality technology. So first of all, there's a scenario. Confront students with a real-world controversy. So the first one we're building is around the controversy of whether MIT should build a biohazard laboratory. So this is modeled after a real controversy that occurred in Boston. Boston University is now building a lab of this type that will study at the highest levels of biosafety the most dangerous diseases. So this generated some controversy locally. There are lots of reasons to be for and against it. So we decided to fictionalize it, situate it at MIT, and then create this game around it that will encourage kids to take sides and discuss, to role play, to gather information. And so similarly to the other games, you move around to different real locations, which have real contextual information, but you also get virtual information. And then they have to collaborate, share their evidence that they've got, form a consensus, and deliver a persuasive argument. The screenshot here is showing a histogram of the opinions of all the players in the game. So what we've done here is taken the idea that you can track in real time what you're thinking about the issue. So you have a slider. And then what you can do is look at where everybody else is. And that will help you in your tactics of persuasion, because you can say, well, I want to try to find those people that are towards the middle of the histogram. So where -5 at the left-hand side means people that are really against this question of should MIT build this lab that's controversial. And on the other end, people are really for it. So I'll try to find those people that are in the middle and persuade them. So it allows kids to sort of strategize about their own opinions and those of others, how persuasion works, how to make arguments, and it's a tool for supporting that. So those are our augmented reality games. Just to wrap up here, I wanted to raise a question. This is a challenge that we have, hopefully to contextualize what we're doing more broadly with what the other presentations are about. So we're talking about handheld games, and how do we make those educational, but still maintain the things that kids are interested in? So we've seen the numbers, we've seen the examples. Kids are really into things like creating their own content on websites. The difficult thing is creating the educational intervention that actually shares those characteristics, and is still educational, because kids have a really good nose for when you're trying to make something that they already like into something educational, they'll run away. So we hope that these principles that Jen elucidated earlier will allow us to preserve the core things about handheld games in particular that get kids engaged as we design educational games for handhelds. I think that's it. That's us.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you so much. These were wonderful presentations, and they were extraordinarily complimentary, I thought. I really want to let people ask questions of the panelists and make their own comments. I just want to just frame this with a couple of observations I've made is about some of the challenges that I think have been made clear through these presentations. Starting out with Julie, I mean, there's clearly a disconnect that's emerged between teachers and their students in terms of their habits and their skills and their comfort with technologies, as well as disconnect in terms of the policies that schools feel they have to or need to implement it by way of rules and regulations, when what the students and some of the younger teachers, it sounds like, want is to be able to use these devices and technologies within class for educational purposes, where schools, I know in New York, where my children are in public school, they're putting on more and more restrictions every day, it seems, on what's allowed or not allowed and on or off and within the class during the school day. And so this sounds like it's an emerging area, perhaps where there's going to be some conflict and where we need to think about how we can play some role. Second, traditionally, researchers who are developing digital libraries and educational publications come from library and publishing backgrounds and are building what I guess now it sounds odd to say a traditional digital library, but hearing these presentations, it sort of sounds like there is a traditional old-fashioned model of a digital library where one presents information and a user comes in, uses it, and leaves. It sounds like this is a problem going forward, yet the skills that some of the developers of these libraries bring come out of environments where this is a model of sharing and disseminating information. Then there's the question that a couple of the panelists raised, that students are looking to work in very different environments, but when the developers of these educational resources are coming from organizations and backgrounds that don't necessarily allow for this kind of new experimentation, and the staff within, I know I can speak for publishing organizations certainly don't normally come with these kinds of skills and perspectives. What happens? Do we try to recreate the capacity to develop these sorts of tools within the library and research and publishing communities? Or do we try to partner with some of these other organizations? And if we do partner, then what are the organizational, the legal, and the business arrangements that would be possible and appropriate for these kinds of partnerships? And will the traditional organizations be open to these kinds of new arrangements? There are lots of other challenges, I'm sure, that I have neglected to mention, but I just thought that might bring some focus to this community and some of the questions and comments that we may have. So I'd like to open this up to questions, comments for the panelists, or areas that you think we need to pursue as a community. Yes.
It is a very big topic right now, and unfortunately in many K-12 schools around the country, they are not addressing how do you authenticate resources. To that point, though, we did some focus groups with kids to ask them, one, how they authenticated resources, and then secondly, what they were being told by their schools, if they were being told anything on how to authenticate resources. The kids were, you're absolutely right, are pretty indiscriminate in terms of how to authenticate resources. When we asked them what they were being told from their schools, and this may shock some of you in the audience, shocked me, they were being told things such as, if it's a .com, don't trust it. If it's a .gov, don't trust it. .org and .edu, that's safe. I mean, when I talk about the lack of sophistication, that is part and parcel of the lack of sophistication in terms of where this topic is right now. So you're absolutely on the money. There needs to be a lot more work done. There are some pockets around the country that are looking at that. I've been yelling about this for years, just because, as I'm saying, the kids are very indiscriminate about it. And that, you know, we're seeing that playing out in terms of the types of sites kids are going to.
Yes, in the back. Mike.
Thank you. Real quickly to carry on that earlier question, have you heard of any initiatives around the country that in educational settings where they're using this lack of clarity over what's an accurate resource versus what's a spurious resource as a kind of sleuth game for kids to, you know, teach them about how beyond just .com and .gov, what confers authenticity, and go out and search for topic X, and let's see who can make the case that they found the real substantial materials and why.
I can only speak from personal experience of a parent of a fourth grader who's right now being taught by her school how to use the web as research. And the way they're doing it is around the solar system project. And each child was assigned a planet. And one of the things that they have to do is they've been required to go and use at least 2 hard copy resources and at least 2 online resources. And one of the interesting things is that in the way that I was taught how to diagram a sentence, they're being taught how to actually diagram a URL so that they know what those pieces mean. The second thing that they're doing is being asked to actually compare and contrast the information. Now, my fourth grader, being the daughter of a geek, you know, obviously believes that the information on the web is way more accurate and that it's much more current. And when she got to the hard copy resources, was pretty surprised that they didn't have it broken down nearly as easily, or the pictures weren't, in her opinion, as clear. You know, she's looking at pictures off of Hubble. She's going, yeah, I can see Scooter. Look at that. Well, I can't see that in the hard copy resource. So that might be because of what the kids' educational resources she went to use were. It might be that they're just not updated. Or it could also be her perception, which she's made very clear to me, that the web is way more accurate and current.
None of them got stuck with Pluto, did they?
Well, that was actually a big question, and they did. And the school was very funny about that. They said the children were allowed to do Pluto, but part of what they had to do was explain its new status.
There we go.
I've also seen web quests that teach that. They'll guide students to different URLs, some specifically chosen because they're not accurate, and to help teach that. But I think, at least from my experience with web quests, it's usually at the teacher basis. A teacher finds it important mm-hmm. to teach their students.
Have a mic there.
Oh, thanks. My biggest concern lately are the rules. I see as schools get more access, then it doesn't even matter because they have more and more rules limiting what the students are supposed to do. And it seems to me that it connects to this larger structure of school standards-based reforms, where the way kids do learn in and out of school is denied, and that there's this structured way of what you're supposed to learn and to test. And I think that probably blocks teachers' creativity as well, as one of your mm-hmm. findings. So I'm wondering what, that really worries me, and I'm just wondering what you think we could do or how that is going to play out.
Do any of the panelists have comments, Julie?
It's worried me for a while as well, and in fact, not that I want to be the doomsayer here, but I'm seeing actually a huge sort of uptick in the rules and regulations. It's not going the right way, in other words. I'm going to share with you just a little personal vignette. I don't know. I see Brad over there typing. He's probably going to steal this idea from me. I think there's an interesting article that should be written about how these rules are really sort of screwing up technology in schools today. Here's my example du jour. You can take this back for cocktail party conversation. High school in Southern California, affluent area. Well-heeled in terms of their technology use. They have a wonderful laptop program they've just instituted. Sounds good, right? Kids are bringing, ninth graders can bring their laptop from home, optional program. They can use it in all their different classes. School has set up a wireless network. Fabulous. Sounds good, right? The way the school has handled it is that it's a secret code for the network that changes daily. And before instruction time starts, the teacher goes around to every laptop to put in the secret code, because we don't want those kids outside of class time accessing that network. Now, I'm amazing, right? Absolutely amazing. The kids are so highly frustrated with, it's almost like looking at, you know, you're standing outside the candy store, and you know there's candy in there, and you don't know how to get in.
Julie, I don't even get it. What don't they want them to be accessing outside of school? Isn't that their work?
Right. They don't want them accessing the network.
All of the things you're talking about.
Why? Because they can hack it and steal
drives. I work at the school as a
bunch of. Yeah.
It's not outside of that, but they're not allowed to use any of the social
integration
tools. It's just like a lookup.
And then get off.
Yeah, it's very, very limited.
Lots of schools are actually blacklisting lots of sites, and so there are teachers that aren't able to get into simple search engines, for example, because the school is concerned about the effect on the students?
Well, there are schools that have filters on .coms. You can't get to a .com site from a K-12 school because they're filters. So, I mean, I think it is a really bad problem. The kids are so highly frustrated that what's starting to happen is that the relevance of the K-12 school environment as a learning environment is going away because the kids are living in this very rich multimedia, self-expression, content-rich world outside of school on either end. They know that the jobs are going to require those type of schools, and yet the school is sitting in the middle, somewhat oblivious to what's happening. Now, of course, there's pockets around the country where fabulous things are happening. I'm talking about sort of what I would say, you know, over 50%.
Is it safety and liability issues?
Yeah,
I think it's fear. I think it's fear of the unknown. I think there's safety and liability issues, but I also think it's a fear of the unknown. You know, if I'm a principal and I have never used IM, okay, or I have never been to MySpace, or I've never used Flickr, you know, if I've never used any of these tools, it's the old immigrant fear of the unknown. Remember, we've got the digital natives and where the rest of us are immigrants. So I think a lot of it is just a fear of the unknown. I mean, a year ago, since I was at this meeting a year ago, I was still doing presentations at K-12 schools explaining to teachers what MySpace was. They had no idea. We'd been tracking the results for 3 years, so we saw where it was going. But, I mean, there's just, I think a lot of it is a fear of the unknown. The liability issue is there, but it's also a fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
This is, I guess, for Karen, because in your slideshow, you started with Web 1.0, and there was this little thing called, you know, where was the bibliography and attribution, and then we went to Web 2.0. How can providers like Yahoo help, scholars attribute what they find in Flickr or Delicious at other places?
Well, I think that's one of the more interesting policy questions that needs to be addressed. I don't know that there are standard mechanisms for attribution. I mean, we don't have the equivalent of URL formatting standards for things like Flickr. But one of the things that we're seeing is that there's a culture of what they call trackback. So where did I get this idea from? How do I let you know where I got that idea from? How do I make sure I put that, for example, in my blog? You know, I don't just say, oh, I got it from Julie. I give you a pointer. I put in Julie's URL. I track back, and I can keep track of the comments of where things came. And you can actually see a family tree, so to speak, of ideas generated out of that. You know, one of the more interesting questions is, if I want to use a public photo that's been done, marked with Creative Commons from Flickr, the Creative Commons process will help you with that attribution, and that's something that we're very excited to see and participate in. But I don't know if I'm supposed to, in a paper where I put in the panda photo, put the URL at the moment, I guess, of the Flickr page where it came from. So I think that's one of the more interesting metadata questions that are on the table, which is, now that we do have user-generated media and user-generated content, how do we make sure that we're giving attribution? Because obviously we know that there are issues both in terms of copyright and in ownership about being able to do that. So the other part of that is, how do we help people learn how to use things like Creative Commons to be able to make sure that that's put out in the field?
Yeah, Dave.
Go back to, I think it was mentioned today on the panel, just in the last couple of days, the Federation of American Scientists report on educational games or the educational potential role of video games came out. And that was conversation this morning at NSF. And we've had conversations like that several times over the last couple of years, yet we've never figured out what we're going to do, what NSF is going to do about that. In other words, and this gets back to Eric's point, too, recognizing there's lots of potential, lots of good anecdotes and individual examples of these games and having an interesting impact on education and learning. What do we need to do to bring that to scale? And what does NSF need to do to take the potential of those games and actually sort of validate them and implement them on a broader scale? And related question, this comes back to my blog comment in preparation for this panel, was, the other frustration we get at NSF is these sorts of innovations are coming down the pike way faster than we can handle them. How do we speed up at the rate the kids are speeding up their processing of new innovations and new media so that we can, at NSF, look at them intelligently before they're by the boards and obsolete or the past generation? Any thoughts on those?
Jennifer and Eric, do you have comments?
So it's a tricky question about the games, how to bring those into education. I wish I could speak to what NSF should do, but I know about some interesting projects. In our lab, there's a project that's a few years old now, but it took a commercial off-the-shelf, massively multiplayer online game and made what we call a mod of this game, a modification to swap out the content of it. So it's a swords and sorcery type game, but the content was replaced with Colonial Williamsburg, and so it became this game about the American Revolution, in which students can play the role of different citizens of a village on the eve of the revolution in 1775 and experience all of the different kinds of social, political, legal, ethical conflicts that are going on, and then actually collaborate with each other to try to decide what to do. One of the things they can do, it turns out, is get a riot to form of their local citizenry. So this is a really interesting application of this game technology into educational content. So we need to do more of that kind of thing. There's some interesting work at Harvard where they're using multi-user virtual environments, a similar idea, and making a game where you can investigate. It's a 19th century town where there's some diseases, and so it's a game about science inquiry, and it's collaborative, but students are in this 3D virtual world gathering data, trying to solve problems. So that I think that kind of thing has promise. It's very difficult. That is an NSF-funded project, that's true.
Maybe Chris Deedy or someone
it
like
is.
That?
Yeah. River City.
Yep.
And they're actually in the process of scaling up right now, so.
So your answer is NSF is already doing work in this area.
Well, Dave, I've noticed in some recent solicitations, NSF is actually mentioning gaming in some examples of the kinds of proposals that would be considered. So it's sort of showing up more frequently. I don't know if the NSF review funding and development process is fast enough. I mean, that's an interesting question. Are we fast enough in all of our organizational funding mechanisms to keep pace with what Julie is seeing is happening? I wanted to ask Jennifer and Eric, what's happening to your games when they're sort of done? I mean, are they being put out into any commercial or non-commercial world for further use?
So all of our stuff is released freely to the public. The problem is, of course, the rapid change of platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Palms are still around. Teachers are using the games that Jennifer described. There's less adoption of the Pocket PC technology, which we use because it allows us to experiment with location awareness. So it's a challenge. I think cell phones will be the next big area for these handheld games, but there's a wide diversity of platforms there, and so it's hard for us to target exactly where we should be developing this stuff.
And I think the other thing is to say that games can be at a huge definition. They're little games. And then there are big games, and the games that you showed today are actually big games to actually go simulate environments, and they get huge groups there. You know, these 10-minute games that teachers can use in their classrooms now, let's reinforce a concept about something and make it physical, make it tactile, make it, you know, real. That's a game, too. It's the notion of actually bringing interactivity into the classroom rather than just static media. And so I'd be, you know, encouraging the NSF to look at the range of places where that can happen and not just sort of look at the sort of big American Revolution game, you know.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a point to your question, Dave. One of the things that K-12 schools, teachers are struggling with right now is how to assess these 21st century skills. How do you show development of problem-solving skills? How do you measure creativity? How do you show critical thinking? And I've thought for a while, you know, there's huge richness in game playing in terms of developing those skills. There's also an inquiry-based science. There's math simulations, all those different things. But there is a real deficit. I just did this research for a school district in Southern California. There's a real deficit of meaningful, usable tools to measure those type of skills. And it might be interesting to approach it from that angle in terms of how do you develop those type of tools and then overlay that in a gaming world and then be able to point out to teachers, to principals, to K-12 administrators, this is your path. Here's a meaningful path to get there for developing those skills.
I think just to piggyback on your points that the former games that you were discussing, the ones that are like 10-minute shots that teach a clear skill, are the ones that have been shown to show up most in schools because teachers can put their thumb on it and say, I see what that teaches. I see how it fits into my standards. However, the latter games that you're discussing, the bigger, more integrated, more interactive, the ones with more 21st century skills, are tougher for teachers to see how they integrate, and that's because there's a pedagogical rub there, and that comes down to the standards movement and NCLB and all the other good stuff. But there's a rub there, and the kids are interacting already with these 21st century skills. That's what these outside technologies are doing for them. And so they're disengaging more and more because the schools aren't doing what they want. So I know with Chris's River City, that's one of his challenges, is finding ways for teachers to easily see his River City move does very 21st century skills, very interactive, collaborative things, and his job, he sees, is to break it down for a teacher so he can say, here's how it fits into your buckets. Here's where it fits in. And I think that's how you're going to sell it to administrators also.
Yes. So actually, in answer to Dave's question, I think NSF has to be funding more of this, you know, passion base, which is what we heard this morning from Dr. Atkins, and in informal stuff, because that's the only way teachers seem to be willing to accept this stuff. Because in the classroom, I mean, all these things that you've mentioned are wonderful, but there's the elephant in the room, which is the state standard exams. Mm-hmm. And unless we think about that and talk about this technology in the same breath, we're not getting it because they're still doing the state exams. So the question is, I mean, if we can do it in after school, we can do this technology and bring in the 21st century skills perhaps in after school programs and just people, kids doing the amateur things and kids doing hobbies and kids doing passion, because as you have explained, you've explained that they are doing it anyway. They're ignoring it. And then when they come into the classroom, they have to stop it, and that disengages them immediately. So either NSF focuses on the 5 years and we ignore what's happening today, or if we're going to look at what's happening today, we have to talk about these state standards.
I think an area that also deserves more attention is identifying the learning modes in which kids are demanding they be taught, and they either seek it out themselves or they look to the schools to teach it and they're not providing it. So defining what those are and then finding innovations that speak to that and hope to project that in their development. So
can we force teachers to allow an hour of inquiry learning and creative activities and critical thinking? And they'll say, you know, who knows, because they don't have a way to grade it at the end, so maybe they won't allow an hour of it.
My only guess would be when I was teaching, there was a young girl whose parents pushed very hard to have her removed from several sections to be taught through computer-mediated instruction, both distance-based education and simulation-type things. And I think my best projection would be you start seeing numbers of kids doing that, and schools are going to have to do something, or they won't have an audience.
Other questions, comments?
And that it seems to me that not only is there a huge gap there between these advances for learning with 21st century e-learning and all of these great things that we've been talking about, not only is there the gap between the assessment as it exists to measure that effectively, but even more damaging, I think, in many cases, the students who are doing that and are learning these skills and are learning to think in a certain way, they're not going to perform well on the assessments because the assessments are structured to test a certain kind of learning and a certain kind of response. And having looked at the exams in Colorado for science, question by question, you know, a kid who knows more, who is thinking in a broader application, is going to do more poorly on that exam, even though they might, you know, have a greater knowledge base in that area. So that enhances that gap that's a dangerous piece.
Well, it's that old thing that, you know, maybe it's dangerous to be a critical thinker if you're a K-12 student, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, please join me in thanking the panelists. And thank you for your questions.
Some really cool stuff.
Thanks.
That was fun, Kate. Yeah, I learned
lot of really recently.